At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 134.EZ1106, certificate number 31305, Bloody Mose.
If you try to Google Bloody Mose, it assumes you mean bloody nose. It gives you hundreds of... You made a typo. Most of the time, Google's right. I didn't make a typo.
Yeah, you don't normally Google Bloody Mose.
Bloody Mose? And that's because this is a recently unearthed story from kind of an underserved nook of history, which is the kind of thing we like.
Yeah.
Here on Omnibus.
We do.
This is the kind of thing we want to go into the record. Sometimes it's whimsical to put these kind of footnote stories into the official record. This is a case where we get to feel very virtuous.
Oh, good.
For putting the story in.
I don't often get to feel that way. You know, we are putting these little-known stories from our time, but by virtue of having put them in the Omnibus, they become widely known and seemingly universal stories for future links, right? So they look back and they go, what do you mean? Yeah. Bloody Mose is like one of our core
The only thing we know about calendars are those two weird ones you guys did shows about. We don't know what your normal calendar was, nor do we care.
Yeah, we had to reinvent math by listening to your shows and then trying to back engineer them.
So maybe you should not try to, if you don't want to fill in the future only about the trivia of a culture, should we just do a show on cars?
Cars. Okay. Here's what cars were.
Jobs. Here's a show called Writing Things Down. Written language. You guys are going to love it. I'm joking about feeling virtuous, but like so many kind of underserved and forgotten crannies of history, this one involves the American continent's troubled history and legacy with people of color, both indigenous people and the enslaved peoples brought here.
Who unearthed this story? Are you going to start with the? I don't mean to jump on top of your notes and
let's
tell you how
some,
to do it.
Let's do some meta narrative here. Ken, talk about your creative choices.
Yeah, Ken, how did you discover the story of Bloody Mose?
This was suggested by a listener named Connor.
Oh,
who contributed to the Patreon?
Well done, Connor.
Sent us a list of like pretty good omnibus ideas, including one about the island of Lanai, which I was very tempted to do because it's got so many. We both love Hawaii,
and
it's got Lanai has so many just crazy episodes from pineapple plantations all the way up to Larry Ellison.
Right. Let's save it because I think Lanai is a good show.
Maybe Connor's going to get two for the price of one here. Yeah. But he mentioned a name that I had never heard before, Francisco Menendez. And I thought, no idea. Conga orchestra leader of the 40s.
I would have bought it.
Portuguese fascist dictator. Who knows?
Right.
Really, literally no way to know.
Yeah, he could be like a fruit and vegetable picker union organizer.
Exactly. You know, there's streets named for him in the Latino districts of many a southwestern city.
Mm-hmm.
Literally no way to know.
Baseball except, player.
Except, right, heroic baseball player. But it was a little bit hard to find out about Francisco Menendez. Not to say that
people with Hispanic names are only fruit pickers and baseball players. Now I'm hearing myself talk.
Well, I said,
he could be, you know, like a great district court judge.
I said, what, maracas-wielding band leader and fascist dictator.
Right.
So I feel like mine are much more empowering.
Yeah. Anyway, duly noted.
But there's no, so yeah, so, you know, could be anything. And there wasn't a lot, you know, it proved to be somewhat hard to research because the story of Menendez and his city is a little bit lost in the maw of history.
He had his own city?
He had his own city.
Oh.
And a remarkable city. I found an article by Jordan Blumetti, who kind of had done original research on the story of Menendez and how it had come to light in the 20th century. You know, historians, including some black historians, Zora Neale Hurston, the famous Florida historian and novelist, had written about the story of Fort Mose, but it hadn't really been followed up by mainstream or white historical societies. It doesn't really fit into the narrative of where our story is set, which is St. Augustine, Florida.
Florida has such a distinguished history of race relations and transitions.
Some of it in St. Augustine. But, you know, famously, America's oldest continuously inhabited city, right? In 1565, right. One Pedro Menendez de Avila, just maybe a few decades after Ponce de Leon, arrives in Florida looking for his son Juan, who has gone missing in a hurricane. His ship is disappeared.
Oh, so he's just...
He crosses an ocean looking for...
Just bopping along the coast Juan, looking for Juan.
Looking for a shipwreck. Finds a good harbor, plants the flag of the King of Spain, and suddenly we have St. Augustine, which, you know, almost 500 years later is still an inhabited city. And, you know, probably a little bit annoyed that Jamestown and the pilgrims up north get all the ink.
Right.
But this is decades before them.
It's a nice little town. Although, you know, the rising seas, of course, are going to wash it away.
Yeah. So for us, it's a nice little town.
Yeah.
It's got a good 10 years to go.
Cute little pad.
And kind of in love with the romance of its history and its status as America's oldest settlement.
Yeah, I mean,
we talked about Cahokia recently on the show, but it's America's oldest European settlement.
How are you going to sell mugs and t-shirts if you don't have some claim to fame?
That's what St. Augustine is. It's a lot of mugs and t-shirts, kind of the lore of privateer era Florida,
yeah,
with all the pirates and the Caribbean and the rum and the slavery, unfortunately. But, you know, that stuff all gets downplayed because they want to sell, you know, mugs with skulls and crossbones on them.
Yeah, the time I visited there, I got out of the car, I walked around, I did a Griswold,
What's a Griswold?
You know the scene in National Lampoon's Vacation where they pull over at the Grand Canyon and the Griswold family gets out and they do like a three-head bob and then back in the car? It's widely known as a Griswold.
In our house, we use the word Griswold for a different tourism-related thing because we prefer the much superior European vacation.
Oh, you're gonna plant a flag that European Vacation is a better film than National Lampoon's Vacation?
I am really. I mean, Christmas Vacation is better than both of them, but this is for us. A Griswold is when you you either take a wrong turn or you don't get off the roundabout at the right exit, so you continue to see the same
landmark again.
Look, kids, Big Ben and Parliament. That's a Griswold to us.
I see.
So you've done the briefest of stops in St. Augustine.
Yeah, I think I walked out on the pier and kind of, you know, like, took a look at the mugs and the t-shirts, drove around. I like to drive up and down the streets a couple of times, but yeah, then I headed out. I had other places to go. Bigger fish to fry.
Bigger alligators to fry elsewhere. So there's this missing chapter in St. Augustine history, kind of a shockingly multicultural Enlightenment era experiment in maybe a different way America could have gone with America's, again, troubled history with indigenous and enslaved peoples.
Is this pre-statehood?
It's long, long pre-statehood. This is pre-nationhood.
Oh.
This is an 18th century story. Despite this, being kind of a footnote in history and of interest to mainly Black historians, it really didn't come out. And the site of Fort Mose was not unearthed until the 20th century, when an amateur local archaeologist began first digging in, metaphorically digging, and then literally digging into the salt marsh, trying to find the setting of this story.
I thought you were going to say digging in the sand there on the beach. that archaeologist was 9 years old.
No, I guess digging in the sand is probably a better idea than digging into a salt marsh.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to get sawgrass and gators.
Yeah,
that's sure. The Florida state motto.
Sawgrass and gators.
Sawgrass, it's on the
Welcome
license plate.
Welcome to Florida.
The story of Francisco Menendez begins in West Africa. He was a young Mandinga kid in the Gambia region of West Africa. I think, for Roots fans our age, it's exactly where that story begins.
Right.
Alex Haley's ancestors. And at some point around 1710, because again, the records were kind of murky and the people who would actually care were not allowed to keep records.
Mm-hmm.
He was taken on a slave ship across the ocean to what was then British North America, the Virginia colony. But, then Virginia stretched into the Carolinas and then kind of sank into the Okefenokee, and at some point Spain started.
Right.
The Spanish,
it also went all the way west to Santa Barbara.
Virginia had the Grand Canyon and the Great Salt Lake in it too. Have you ever seen one of those maps where like the period maps where the original 13 colonies kind of just extend, their land grants extend west?
Yeah.
So it's like Connecticut is this little tiny band that like
hits
the Great Lakes, but then starts again in Michigan somehow. It's a shame that's not you can't uphold those in court. The problem with, again, this chronicle is we don't have, Menendez never kept any kind of diary or journal, because he was a slave and wasn't allowed to. But from what we know of him, it's a fascinating story. He escapes twice his plantation where he's being forced to work into the swamps. At one point, he spends some years with the Yamasee Indians, a local tribe, and in fact leads these Native Americans in campaigns against the British, against the plantation owners in the area. So, he's on the right side during the Indian Wars.
Either a warrior when he was in Gambia or a natural born fighter.
A talented young person in a lot of respects. I guess there's some history work on this I wasn't aware of that really emphasizes that for a lot of these, what are called the Atlantic Creole people of this time, these displaced and enslaved people, it was a terrible atrocity, of course, but in many individual cases, it created people who were incredibly linguistically facile, could speak multiple languages, had great social agility. They were, comfortable with with this Native American tribe, but also they could deal with their white oppressors, and they could speak many of the African languages of the other slave peoples, and just incredible, plastic brains, adaptable to all these terrible situations they were being forced to confront and stay afloat in, and many of them just did so with incredible grace and ability. Apparently,
that's got to be a human trait that evolved over millennia, right? Because that had to have been a commonplace situation for a human being to find themselves
be on the wrong side of a war or a slave trade.
Yeah, right. Captured by one group of people and brought somewhere else and used initially as an interpreter, but then you become enmeshed in all these
trying to figure out an angle, trying to figure out how to just stay afloat.
In Alexandria or in Constantinople, I'm around the world, right?
Yeah.
You would have a real advantage if you had that kind of plasticity.
And maybe it's a small group of people that actually just catch enough breaks to be able to, who gets the call from the satrap at the right time. And suddenly this person becomes Joseph in Egypt and has a privileged position that, that 100 people, no matter how able, wouldn't be able to attain.
I don't have that quality. I want macaroni and cheese every Thursday. I'm really set in my ways. I wear four black t-shirts.
I feel like I would just keep my head down, Like there's never going to be the Jennings slave revolt.
Of course,
guys, I think we should maybe do what he says.
Hey guys,
he just thinks we should work till all night. And there'd be a lot less trouble if we did it. But you, so I really admire this kind of, I mean, I admire the Nat Turners of the world who are like, this sucks.
Yeah.
But also this guy who is like, how do I get out of here and, you know, make some, make a better world.
But also not just run, turn around and right. take up arms.
Like instead of going as far as he can, he's like, now that I've got these guys with tomahawks,
right.
you know, now we got some bows and arrows and stone headed axes. I've got a list of people, you know, it's Game of Thrones.
So they start a frontier.
Yes. And there is a frontier between, again, the Carolinas and then across the St. Mary's River into Florida. And what's interesting is that the situation vis-a-vis slavery is very different on either side of that river.
The Spanish.
Now, the Spanish hate the British, and the British hate the Spanish. They're fighting for superiority in this new global geopolitical realm. There's a whole hemisphere to fight over.
Still true to this day.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't want the Spanish to come off super great in this story because they are totally doing genocides all over the Caribbean.
They invented it. Well, at least in the Americas.
It was called genocidio. We had to translate it. No, I don't know if that's true or not. But yeah, you know, they don't have the best track record with indigenous people in the Caribbean. I don't think we need to
right.
make that case. But they hate the, but slavery is treated differently in the law there. And again, I want to stay on the right side of not being like, hey, this is the good kind of slavery.
Are you both sidesing the Spanish and English game?
I'm going to get to the point of defending Spanish slavery, at least in comparison to the English slavery.
Okay.
And I do not want to sound like one of these, hey, a lot of those masters were actually pretty chill to the slaves, guys.
Let me just asterisk here that I am against slavery. I don't know about Ken.
You hate all the kinds equally. I do. And even to distinguish between them seems like, you know. Really, a waste of time.
I have on my list of omnibus topics the Barbary pirates, and we're really going to get into it then.
We're going to get some pirates this time too. If anybody is thinking of tuning out because we keep talking about
ranking slaveries,
ranking slaveries, there will be pirates. Please stick around, and not the kind of baseball pirates that outfielder Francisco Menendez played for before his tragic plane crash. In Spain, you know, the British parts of the world at this time, basically, you know, if you're black, you're a slave. You know, that's like a natural state for a certain kind of person disfavored by God. You know, you're just automatically a slave and you do what we say. In Spain, there's no such system. Don't get me wrong, they're enslaving a ton of black people and native tribes.
But in Spain, it's more about becoming Catholic.
That's a huge part of it. You know, slaves have legal rights there. They can, you know, take people to court. They can have property. You know, there's some legal protections. And as a tactic, you know, the kind of slavery being wielded there is mostly religious. You know, it's a different kind of slavery. But look, if you are a baptized Catholic and if you swear allegiance to the King of Spain, and you know, you would be a really valuable tool in our arsenal against the hated British. So the King of Spain would love to build up black militias of runaway slaves from British plantations, or Maroons, as they're called at the time. So in 1725, Menendez leads a group of runaway slaves across the St. Mary's River.
He heads south.
Into Florida. Yeah. So in the early 18th century, the Underground Railroad goes south.
Yeah.
If you want to get off these awful plantations to freedom, you head south into the swamp.
I mean, I bet you once they got there, they didn't find the abolitionist Massachusetts of their dreams.
There weren't starchy, righteous 60-year-old women to give them a
to sing hymns
and give them clean clothes, right? But what you do have is the Catholic Church saying, "Look, just get baptized and join the army for His Majesty, whoever the King of Spain is in whatever part of the 18th century this is," and and you can be part of the culture. Spain's got a different history regarding multiculturalism than England does. You know, they've had a mixed society for years. You know, the Moorish influence on Iberia has come and gone.
They have a great track record with the Sephardic Jews.
Oh man! Speaking of Spain and medieval Spain and multiculturalism, yeah, you know, we don't want to say they have a great record, but I mean they're accustomed to.
Proximity to Africa, it's a different calculation.
Yeah. And having, you know, North African peoples coming and going. So, you know, it doesn't freak them out that, you know, there might be a part of this town where people of color live. You know, there's a part of this town where people speak a different language. That's kind of expected in some of these old Spanish cities. And also they've been in the Caribbean for hundreds of years, and they've chartered free black colonies in Panama and Venezuela and some of their islands, for the same reason, you know, to create
a bulwark against British intrusion.
It's exactly what it is. They're not above using these people who already hate, their former British slave owners.
Enter Sir Francis Drake.
What do you want to say about Francis Drake?
I got nothing to say about him. You know, okay. One of my great, 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 great ancestors, Captain John Rochester, was.
This seems like it would be played by you in a costume in the movie. Oh, of course, John Rochester.
Here he is.
I got it.
That's an ex-parrot taped to my shoulder. God, that's such a nerd reference. I'm so sorry to everyone.
We love Monty Python here, don't we, folks? Let's stop for a second and do our top 10 favorite Red Dwarf episodes. Go.
John Rochester was given a charter, to, you know, take a ship out and fight the Spanish in whatever that would have been, 16-aught.
How'd he do? Is there a buried treasure maybe you could find?
Well, we're still here.
So if he's a direct ancestor,
yeah,
he must have done okay.
He did well enough to get a land grant there around Jamestown.
Do you feel like you might be descended from some dusky-eyed Caribbean Creole woman who fell in love with the dotty Captain Roderick?
I would love nothing more, but when we do those DNA tests, there's no evidence that there's anything interesting about us. Like, the most interesting thing is like the people from Cardiff.
Dusky-eyed, zero.
Zero amount.
So the governor of Florida will offer freedom to these escaped slaves, but it's pretty spotty because, again, this is the early 1700s.
Right.
And I'm sure nobody likes black people then, you know, America is not that different then from now. So not everybody gets, you know, it's very much a judicial and clerical roulette, whether you actually get freed or not.
But it wasn't a plantation culture. It was definitely more of a privateer culture.
People are hunting and fishing and trying to sink British ships. it's a mercantile culture as well, but yeah, it's not like, you know, in the Carolinas at this point, the black population, the slave population, outnumbers their masters,
right?
Because that's just the kind of labor you need to run that kind of awful system. But Menendez himself, you know, another sign of his kind of initiative and ability, he actually petitions the crown. He writes letters to to Madrid, or what would be the capital of Spain? Is it still in Toledo in the early 1700s?
Yeah, probably.
I'm not going to stop to look it up. He writes letters to Spain. Let's put it that way.
Okay,
asking for.
La Corte Real.
Asking for universal freedom for all escaped slaves entering Florida.
From the nascent United States. From the British colonies.
From those British colonies.
He's not suggesting that the enslaved people of Guyana are also released.
No, but if you enter and get baptized, he thinks all those maroons should be freed. And the governor of Florida agrees. And in 1738, I think, largely in response to Menendez's petition, all such former slaves have legal freedom.
Huh.
So where do you put them? A new town is founded called Gracia Real de Santa Teresa de Mose near St. Augustine. I mean, maybe this is a sign that
they're not completely
given their
rights.
It's the equivalent of the 1960s era. Well, what if they married your daughter, you know?
You're free. Where are you going to live?
You're free. Let's find you someplace over there in the salt marsh.
Right.
Wouldn't that be nice? A new town is founded. You know, Gracia Real is, you know, in honor of the royal grace of His Majesty who has allowed this experiment to occur.
Mm-hmm.
And even though this new town has a Catholic priest on site and it has a Spanish military commander on site, Menendez himself has, you know, proved so able that he's made a captain and he is in charge of this new city, which is called Fort Mose, because what, of course, Spain is really interested in is, you know, first of all, taking as many slaves, disrupting the affluent British slave economy of the Carolinas, and then also creating, as you say,
a Liberia in the Americas.
Well, yeah, but a library that stands between them enemies, arming some. So the interesting thing about the story is there is a Liberia in Florida, 50 years before America is a country.
Right.
Almost. And
now, is this a case where Menendez is the one charismatic leader who, given authority over a community founded in his name, is a benevolent and wonderful person into old age?
He seems well. I mean, he continues to have other adventures. He seems to be well liked by the community. Again, just not a lot of firsthand ink on this guy. He doesn't turn evil. If that's what you're concerned about.
I was worried because usually when someone leads an escaped group and forms a new city, they become a monster.
There is some violence to come. It is bloody Mose, but it's a kind we can get behind. So this underground railroad continues of Indian guides bringing parties of ex-slaves through the swamps.
Oh.
And suddenly they have a free city to go to. You know, this becomes...
It's a beacon.
Yeah, it's a city on a hill.
Oh, wow.
But like a very different, you know, when we talk about the Puritan city on a hill, that's a pretty white city.
Yeah.
And they're not treating the local natives great.
Probably a lot less condescension in the cities to the south.
Yeah, I mean, Florida does not have a hill. It's in Florida, so it's a city in a city in a bog.
In a swamp marsh, right?
Yeah, I can't believe there's no city in a bog speech by Ronald Reagan. But the existence of this city and the trickle of slaves out of the Carolinas and what happens in 1740 actually begins to inspire slave rebellions up north in British territory. So the King of Spain is looking very smart here with his plan to kind of destabilize the Virginia colony with thought warfare and
he's the Russian trolls of his time. He's just on Facebook just putting out some crazy theories.
He's putting them on parchment and handing them to a Seminole guy to take north. But yeah, that's the equivalent of a bot farm in the 1730s. And it's exactly, I mean, the parallels to 19th century America are really interesting because, you know, slave owners get pissed off in the Carolinas. They hire professional slave catchers who are supposed to head into enemy territory and recover their property, but this time they're headed south.
I always imagine that as a thing where they're headed up into Maryland, but
the first time it happened, they're like heading down to Florida to be like, "Hey, senor, you've got our property."
So is Mobile part of has Alabama become an American territory at this point? I mean, when does Mobile and all of that, like Gulf Coast, stop being Spanish?
I feel like Spain, I mean, we're gonna get to the end of Spanish.
But is that all the way up to the Louisiana Purchase?
Yeah, at this time, it ends before America's a country. Like Spanish Florida has some rough times here in a second. But yeah, Florida Occidental, you know, the western part of Spain's dominion there, goes all the way to the Mississippi.
Yeah,
so it's Mobile and what is today New Orleans. Right. Nueva Orleans at the under Spanish rule.
Is that really what they called it?
Yeah, I think so.
Huh.
Well, I mean, I think it was probably founded by the French who called it New Orleans, and then when it came under Spanish dominion,
they called it Nueva Orleans. They didn't call it Nuevo Toledo.
What's the Spanish word for? What's the Spanish equivalent of Orleans? You have to find out who the Spanish Joan of Arc is.
But we didn't call New York New Amsterdam. We changed the name.
It was once New Amsterdam.
Yeah. Why they changed it? I know. I know why.
You know?
Yeah.
But you don't want to tell?
No, I'll tell.
I mean, Amsterdam is maybe more closely associated with, you know, it's the capital of one of your rivals.
Yeah, right. Also, it's low-lying swamp. You know, that's not what New York... I guess down in the Battery, it was kind of a low-lying swamp.
It may have been more of a kissing up to, you know, whoever His Excellency the Duke of York was. I think it was the king's brother or something. So there was probably some guy who wanted to, you know, a company gets sold you've got a...
99%. That's the story.
So in 1740, the War of Jenkins' Ear breaks out. You know, the hostility, you know, the tension between Spain and Britain in the New World finally boils over into war. Only the British call it the War of Jenkins' Ear because that's their propaganda thing.
Really hard. Can you say that in Spanish? The War of Jenkins' Ear?
La Guerra de la Oreja de la Idiota Jenkins. I wonder what their name for it is. I'm sure it's the War of British Aggression or something.
Yeah, right.
But it was, you know, as you say, a battle of privateers and battles at sea.
How did Jenkins' ear get involved?
I think it was cut off with a saber.
Yes.
And so, and then the earless Captain Jenkins gets paraded in front of Parliament. Like, look what these evil Spanish pests have been doing to our brave.
They take him back to inflame emotion.
The earless Jenkins becomes a propaganda sign. So the whole war is called the War of Jenkins' Ear. Just like we might say,
the pig war.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you just name the war for the inciting incident. Like if we had called
Tonkin Gulf incident.
The Tonkin Gulf War, yeah. Or our 20-year adventure in Afghanistan could have been the 9/11 War.
The 9/11 War, that should have been called that.
As part of the War of Jenkins' Ear, Jonathan Oglethorpe, the founder of the new colony of Georgia, heads south to make war on Spanish Florida. I said Jonathan Oglethorpe, but it's James Oglethorpe.
Georgia had a great initial history. Boy, they really did a job down there.
Luckily, things quickly turned good there, and nothing bad ever happened in Georgia again. So he leads an army south into Florida, and Fort Mosse has become a symbol of Spanish nose thumbing, and you know, probably also of African American ingenuity and success. It's a thriving example of exactly what they don't want in Georgia.
And is it a city of freed slaves, or is it like a polyglot, multicultural? There are Native Americans there.
There's Native Americans. There's a bunch of different languages being spoken: English, Spanish, African languages, Native American languages.
God, it sounds like a fun town.
Cultures are mixing. It seems to be going well, but as soon as Oglethorpe's army comes, everybody has to leave Fort Mosse because, you know, despite the name, it's not a great fort. And they have to retreat to an actual masonry fort in St. Augustine. So everybody hunkers down in Castillo de San Marcos.
It's not a very big Castillo, so that's going to be uncomfortable.
No, I think it's still there to this day. And, you know, and they just wait for the British cannon fire to end. And the siege continues for a month, and Menendez finally is fed up. And we know he's a man of great military ability. He decides to lead a daring pre-dawn raid on his former home of Fort Mosse, which is now being occupied by Oglethorpe's men.
It's the best kind of raid. Daring, pre-dawn.
And pre-dawn.
Yeah. And against the British.
You don't want to do a cowardly... What would a cowardly pre-dawn raid be? Like, maybe it's an accident?
Well, no, you sneak around and you know, it's like a sabotage raid rather than like a frontal assault.
It's like getting up in a hotel room, trying to use the bathroom without waking up the other person.
Yeah, it's like the type of thing that Ken Jennings would do if he was leading a Slade revolt. Hey, yeah. Everybody, let's keep
it down. And Menendez has no such compunction, because this is where Mosse gets its new name, Bloody Mosse. Again, this is an English propaganda title, because as you might imagine, Menendez's army of freed slaves is merciless. There's little love lost between them and their.
So this is the little bighorn pre-American
Florida.
Yeah.
So British soldiers are bludgeoned. They are castrated. They are beheaded. I mean, the kinds of atrocities you feel bad about. But then in a slave revolt, you're kind of like, well, you know, if anybody ever had bludgeoning coming, nobody's ever really like, Nat Turner should have been nicer to those plantation owners, you know? So I feel like even today, in a culture that's where we're very correctly anti-violence.
Yes.
You know.
Famously. I mean, the King William's War and all those wars up in Yankeeville, there was a lot of burning everyone to death up there, too. It was kind of the style of the time.
Sure. And different cultures have different patterns of violence. You know, what represents valor in war might, you know, seem like an atrocity on the other side, and, you know, creates kind of racist tropes about scalping and whatnot. But in this case, I think we can feel pretty good.
So they wipe them out. Well, you know, your name is Jennings and my name is Roderick. We're rooting for the ones that defeat our English ancestors.
Because it's a kind of privilege we have. Yeah. We know we came out okay with really a lot of the money of whatever this plantation economy was. So we have unfortunately, we have the ease to say, man, yeah, stick it to the man, Francisco. very few British survivors. Oglethorpe, you know, heads back to the Carolinas Georgia now, with his tail between his legs. And Mosse is spared. And again, this becomes, like Jenkins' Ear, a symbol of the evil Spanish and, you know, the I assume that, you know, what they would consider the cunning subhuman non-white enemy.
I wonder if it played into, it must have played into the narrative that actually like freeing slaves was a dangerous course to take because invariably they would wipe us out, stab you
with a saber. Yeah. And they're not wrong. You know, word of the Mosse success spreads north and it's thought to have inspired many similar slave rebellions up north. You know, the success of Mosse leads to the Stono Rebellion and other kinds of slave uprisings in the Carolinas at this time.
So why is Menendez not a symbol of freedom?
Yeah, you mean to this,
the Americas?
You mean to this day? Why is there not stuff named after him?
Yeah, why did he not become a rallying cry?
I think it's just because it's so surprisingly early. You know, nobody's looking for black heroes in the 1730s in Florida, of all places. You know, so he's gone under the radar, and again because little has survived about him.
And Florida is still disconnected from the United States
It's its own kind of culture, right?
Right, interesting.
Just like it is today. So Fort Mosse, you know, they can retake the fort, but they eventually move back to St. Augustine, and actually, they actually joined the culture there. Menendez does not. He's now had a taste of revenge against his oppressors, and he knows what will probably serve him well career-wise. He wants to be a pirate.
Yeah,
I mean. Yeah. Isn't that what you would do? You win one military engagement, you're like, I'm gonna be a pirate now.
100%. There is a lot of it's a growth industry at the time, piracy.
Yeah. I mean, the British are growing and making stuff, and Spain is taking it and burying it on beaches. there's two kinds of jobs.
Yeah. There's a lot of rum, there's some Spanish gold still.
So Menendez hops aboard the Spanish Armada and heads to Europe because he wants to petition the king. It's a time when I guess there's not a lot of precedent for different kinds of, I mean, there's plenty of precedent for racism, but within the Spanish Navy, maybe not. Like, I could be the black captain of a ship, you know?
Well, they're impressing people into service in every Navy, right? So I think the Navy was always
very polyglot.
Because it's like, hey, you.
But this guy could actually be the captain. This guy would not be swabbing the decks.
Right, you know?
He's a hero. So he wants to petition the king, like, I feel like I've earned like not just legitimacy, but like I should have a pension. I should have officer status. Did you see how many people I bludgeoned and castrated at Fort Mosse?
Here, here.
Unfortunately, on his way to Spain, his ship is captured by the British ship Revenge, appropriately named off North Carolina.
It's a little too late to enter Francis Drake.
Yeah, Drake. It's not Drake, but it's
one Captain Kidd or somebody.
And Menendez, unfortunately, has become a propaganda symbol. He is recognized immediately as the perpetrator of the atrocities of Fort Mosse. He is tortured. One of the historical records says he was brined and pickled.
Oh, dear.
Which sounds, I don't know what that is, but it sounds worse than waterboarding.
Sure. You put him in a pickle barrel.
All the osmotic pressure.
Yeah, your skin's not going to like that.
Water out of your body.
Look.
And he is returned to slavery in the Bahamas. He's back on the plantation.
They don't kill him. They just put him back in chains?
I mean,
a fate worse than death.
It really is. Like, killing might be a mercy as opposed to, hey, why don't you go work a sugar plantation or whatever it is in the Bahamas?
Man.
Like, they really know how to stick it to a guy. And this is just the kind of risk that escaped slaves always ran. No matter, you know, he's on his way to petition the king of Spain. He's a military hero, and nope. Just like the Solomon Northrop guy in 12 Years a Slave, he's back in the Bahamas.
Caribbean plantation culture, among the worst.
Are you grading slavery?
I'm going to say that the slaveries in the Caribbean were some bad slaves.
0 out of 10 stars.
Yeah.
I'm going to write some very bad Yelp reviews about Bahamian.
I would say Bahamian because I mispronounce things and invent words.
Well, it's because it's Panamanian, but really that's insane. It would be
Bahamian.
Our Canadian listeners know that it would be Bahamian.
But Bahamian just sounds like the Baha'i faith a little bit.
It does. You don't like that?
No, I love. Hey, listen, I'm not coming out against Baha'i.
No, they'll get you. But in his absence, now that the families of Fort Mosse are moved back into St. Augustine, suddenly St. Augustine now has this class of freed blacks who are no longer off across the marsh, but are mingling with the population. They have trades, you know, they're builders, and they are, you know, capturing wild horses and cattle and becoming, you know, they own livestock, they're ranchers.
But also versed somewhat in the culture of the Virginias.
Yeah, Virginia. Many of them. So yeah, they just kind of contribute to this melting pot of St. Augustine, which now has this class of polyglot, multicultural free blacks.
Right.
And then Menendez returns.
He escapes.
We don't know how. Was he, you know, ransomed or traded? Did he escape? Did he somehow buy his freedom? He wangles his way back.
Wangle? Is that a word? Is that a colonial word?
Probably at the time. At the time. Do you not wangle?
I don't want anyone.
I don't want you wangling during the show.
No, I don't want anyone wangling around me or to me. Don't at wangle me.
But by the time he gets back, Fort Mosay has been rebuilt. And we don't know why. I mean, it's easy to read this as, you know, for 12 years, this was an example of, you know, maybe a different kind of colonial America. But
is it rebuilt as a symbolic gesture, or is it doesn't sound like a nice place to live?
No, it's rebuilt in a different place. Oh. You know, the second Fort Mosay is elsewhere off in the marshes, but it does seem like, you know, this is where the black population is going to live. And who knows that, you know, that I don't think the history says whether that's a people wanting their autonomy or a people getting sick of the aggressions, big and small, of the moneyed class in St. Augustine, or if it's outright
people that love mosquitoes.
Right. There's just not enough sawgrass and mosquitoes in the town. I mean, you know, maybe they wanted more space and autonomy. I don't know. It also seems very likely that the city is not in love with a black population at a time when, you know, there's a lot of built-in religious ideas about their inferiority. So, but Menendez comes back and leads this new second Fort Mosay. And this all happens just in time for the Seven Years' War to break out. And Spanish Florida pretty much collapses. It's broke. It turns out it cannot compete with the thriving plantation culture built on the backs of slaves just a few hundred miles north. And as a result, the treaty at the end of the war cedes Florida to Britain in exchange for letting Spain keep Cuba. They were like, please let us have Cuba. But they had to give up Florida. And now
our slave economy is really booming in Cuba. You can keep our dysfunctional slave economy.
So there's no point to Fort Most now, you know, like, you know, Spain, it was great to have a black militia there, but now there's nobody to have a black militia against. So this experiment ends, and the 50 free black residents still living in Mosay, including Menendez and his family, decamp for Cuba, you know, the last bastion of not British slave culture in that part of the Caribbean. They found a new town called St. Augustine. This is St. Augustine Dos, St. Augustine of Nueva Florida. They're considering Cuba Nueva Florida, you know.
Right.
And at that point, the community kind of disappears from history. There's no longer any record of what happens to Menendez and his 50 emigrants from Fort Mosay.
St. Augustine not being one of the main cities of Cuba.
Yeah, I don't know if it even survives to this day. Like, is there a St. Augustine, San Agustin, Cuba now?
It does not appear. At least when you Google St. Augustine, Cuba, it autofills to St. Augustine Cuban restaurant.
Probably in Miami Beach or something. But it's just an interesting, you know, and you asked about how this all came up. There was in the 20th century, there's kind of an interesting story where St. Augustine actually is the site of a bunch of civil rights battles, a lot of sit-ins, a lot of swim-ins, you know, because it's got a tourist trade. It's got this symbolic import as America's oldest city. And it's still not treating its black people great in the 60s, as you might imagine. So it's not, nobody's that interested in studying African-American history of the region, but there's this amateur archaeologist named Jack Williams, who's a World War II veteran, who is really interested in, as you might imagine for a white guy of this era, he's really interested in military history.
Wait a minute.
And he's, or today, or anybody who listens to the Thursday Omnibus. So he's very interested.
Second only to my train sets.
He's interested in finding Fort Mosay, and you know, not so much because he cares about its racial significance, but just because of, you know, other military campaigns that have involved that part of Florida. And he finally tracks down where it is, does some digs, finds some rum bottles and some amulets, and says this is Fort Mosse. The local historical society hates him because he's an outsider and they don't care about Black history, but he finally is able to get the University of Florida to come check it out and sign off and say, yes, this is where this early city of free blacks was.
Does do any foundations survive? Is it actually like a, is it just a shell midden, or is it a town?
They dredged that part of the marsh to build modern St. Augustine. So the place where Fort Mosse was located is no longer solid ground. So you can go there today. There was a long legal battle between Williams and the state because he tried, once he found out where it was and they were like, oh, this is like actual military history, Florida history, Black history. The state tried to buy it to make it a monument or whatever, and offered him, you know, in his opinion, a tenth what it was worth. He kept turning down their offers. They finally took him to court and took it.
He owned it somehow?
Yeah, he had, once he knew what it was, he had bought the land.
Oh.
And so depending on who you ask, you know, his descendant, the state claimed eminent domain and just took, and basically took it from him for much, half what he thought it was worth.
Right.
This is some interesting research that was done by a web journalist and blogger named Jordan Blumetti. He tracked down this Jack Williams guy's descendants, and they still think he was, you know, mistreated by the state, and the local historical society was, you know, mad that he got there first. And, you know, I think the state would say that he was just some crackpot.
Sure. Guy with a metal detector.
Guy with a metal detector.
I'm seeing here the Fort Mosse Historic State Park.
Yes.
They're actually, they have like black militiamen in full on Revolutionary War reenactment costumes firing muskets. That's the whole thing.
That might be kind of a once a year thing. I think in fact there is now a state park there, but a state, you know, historical monument there, but I think it's kind of a, you know, relative to the how important and inspiring this story could be, it's a pretty small, rundown visitor center.
A little swampy.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's just a boardwalk where you can walk out and look and say, yeah, over there in what is now this awful bog, there was once a thriving black city.
Let me just asterisk there and say, I'm pro-bog. I recognize that bogs are
a
vital part of the ecosystem, not like Ken, who's against bogs.
I'm not against bogs. I have a friend and I always, when we're at a place that has one of those interpretive signs that tells you how the importance of the wetlands, you know, what a complicated thriving ecosystem, you know, we always take a picture of those and send them to each other. Because no matter where in the world you are, there will always be this nearly identical sign
telling
you how great the wetlands
are. It's about birds, Ken. They need a place to land.
And I think that is who comes to this visitor center. You know, you think it would be black kids on field trips, but it's a lot of birders.
Oh, right.
Hoping to see the
green tufted
yellow-bellied sapsucker.
Sure, swan heron.
Or whatever it is. But there's a sign there that says, you know, welcome to freedom, you know, trying to recover some of this Underground Railroad narrative. But you know, even though the park is quiet and little visited, it really does make you think, you know, is there an alternate America? You know, like, could there be a different blueprint for the continent where, you know, it was a kind of a bustling Creole vibe where everybody was different, but everybody had got along. You know, what if Spain had won that geopolitical battle and the city on the hill had included freed black people and the nearby tribes and, you know, anybody else?
I think we can look around all of Latin America and see where Spain did win that battle. Questionable result.
Maybe Florida's the only place.
right in the middle, just a little,
it's between
a little colony.
Between the genocides and the plantations, you know, maybe there was a little Venn diagram overlap.
I think it is great, though, and I think the 21st century is going to see a lot more archaeology devoted to the black experience in America and more recognition. I mean, you see this with black graveyards that started there with that excavation in lower Manhattan, and now a recognition that all the historic graveyards of the black community, a lot of them were paved over and turned into freeway overpasses. And there's all this interest in going back and establishing, because, you know, when we think about the tourist sites of colonial America, they represent a kind of archipelago that tells the story of the early United States. And there's all that black erasure.
It's white.
Yeah. Right. And every, you know, and you'll have like, oh, there's some reenactors over here in the slave cabin. Don't they look happy?
But some places still use the slave cabins for like weddings and corporate events.
Right.
You know?
And so
it's the only part of the plantation that survives with the original architecture.
Even if this is like a, like a small little park, if it is an example of like the, a beginning of a corresponding set of national parks and, you know, like sites where this
parallel America,
yeah, parallel, yeah, America, and the story is being told, and it's being told in a way that's, you know, given its rightful place. It's wonderful.
I was at an event not long ago where Bryan Stevenson spoke. He's the guy that he started the Equal Justice Initiative to try to get you know, better outcomes for poor people and minorities in the criminal justice system in prisons in the South mostly. That he was played by Michael B. Jordan in a recent movie, Just Mercy.
And not that one where he's not like a Jason Bourne type character.
No.
Okay.
No. Oh yeah, he's Jack Ryan now.
I've been meaning to watch that movie. Yeah,
and also not the one where he hates Black Panther. He's right. the one where he's a young struggling lawyer trying to get a guy off death row.
Oh, okay, good. I've seen that movie.
One of those. Yeah. And
Susan Sarandon in that?
You'd think. Brie Larson. And he's talking about this new project. He just opened kind of a museum in Montgomery, Alabama, where he lives, kind of the history of the, what you're talking about, kind of the undertold stories of the Black experience. And he was saying one project he has is to try to find out if there's, you know, are there places where technology can actually find slave ships? Can you find wrecked slave ships? Can you find human remains from the, you know, because famously, what, a third didn't make it across the,
yeah, right,
ocean, and were just, you know, dumped like excess cargo. You know, like, are there different depths where some of those remains might survive? You know, like,
whoa,
could those become graveyards? Could we find those places and make them destinations? And I was just fascinated, you know, because think of all the, how many tens of millions of dollars have gone into trying to get some newel post from a banister on the Titanic, or, yeah, you know, or silverware from some other ship, or some, you know, your booty from a Spanish galleon.
Well, that's the thing. There's so much energy going into finding those ships that are laden with Inca gold.
Right. And yet, like, what could be more symbolic, you know, devastatingly symbolic than the slave ships? And nobody's pouring money into trying to find those remains. So that's like something he's trying to head up for the first time. And I was like, that'd be fascinating. Like, why are we trying to get forks off the Titanic when we could be doing this?
Well, it does seem like something that futurelings will listen to this program and look back and sort of not comprehend a time when one story of the Americas had been, right, told, and this, you know, this like companion story, simultaneous, equally like extraordinary, but like founded in pain.
Because they're racially enlightened, they don't see the differences. It would be like us looking back at the, you know, Chinese history of the three warring kingdoms period and like being expected to pick which of the warring kingdom was the good one, you know?
Well, so much of what you think of as like the history as told from Egypt to Greece, et cetera, like we don't have a sense of like who, I mean, we know from Hippocrates or whatever that some ideas, but we don't know the culture, right?
I think a lot of it might be just the urge to make things linear. Yeah, you know, we right, have our kids draw timelines in school, and so you think of human history as, it goes like this: Egypt, then Greece, then Rome, then, you know.
Yeah.
No, you are drawing one line, but it's a big planet.
Yeah, the Ethiopians have a very different timeline. And that concludes Bloody Mose, entry 134.EZ1106, certificate number 31305 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, and the implausible event that you don't know all about these stories that we're now, for the first time, really adding to the historic record in the form, historic record that survives the apocalypse.
It's a bummer for the real historians that did this work, and then you know, people just hear us talk about it.
Well, because every once in a while, you or I will actually mention the person. That did right. It's like, oh, his name was Bob Jenkinstein or something. I'm not sure.
I mentioned Jordan Blumetti in this show, so I feel a little less guilty.
But you can find our actual original research at Omnibus Project on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Ken is at Ken Jennings. I am / was at John Roderick. Also, you can find me at patreon.com/John Roderick. You can email us, which we encourage you to do. Although, if you're going to email us with, if you're going to shake a frying pan at us because we got some minute detail wrong, send it to goFyourself@theomnibusproject.
Dead letter office.
gmail.com. But no, please email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com.
We welcome all your complaints. We do a monthly show about them.
Yep. Ken and Mindy will read your emails, and then the ones that are expressly nice to me, they send me. I think the ones that are mean about me, they delete.
Yeah, we actually haven't got one of those. But if we ever got a nice thing about you, we would send it to you.
That's why I only get one email a month. You can support the show, and we encourage you to do it. This show was suggested to us by a Patreon supporter, and look how it turned out. Super good.
Thanks, Connor.
You can support the show at patreon.com/omnibusproject. For as little as $5 a month, you can hear our monthly addenda show, and there are all kinds of goods and services available there. Also, check out our Omnibus Project t-shirts that are available. Ken, where can futurelings and interested listeners find our Omnibus Project t-shirts?
Go to omnibusproject.com/store to find shirts and hoodies and magnets and mugs and more. The latest shirts are pretty cool. It's the original Omnibus and Futurelings design, but the Omnibus is in cool sparkly gold now.
Yeah.
And the Futureling shirt glows in the dark.
See,
I don't know. So I don't know what that's for.
That's pretty hot.
For late night, for daring pre-dawn raids.
Well, no, you don't want to wear it in a daring pre-dawn raid, but a daring pre-dawn rave.
There you go.
You might want your glow-in-the-dark Omnibus shirt.
That's my favorite kind of rave. A daring one.
No, that was actually, I was just doing like a cool funk beat. It would be.
I don't know. You're the beatboxer here.
That's right.
I'm just opening your mail.
You can go to Omnibus Futurelings, wherever Futurelings are found, on Discord and Reddit.
I feel like they just started a non-Facebook community, but the problem is the only place I read about it was on Facebook.
I think it's on Discord. Oh. They have a new Futurelings group over there. Anyway, if you are savvy enough to look for Futurelings groups, you will probably find them. Yeah, savvy enough to find them. And you can send us mail. And this is very exciting to us. We love opening mail. Send us actual mail at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. I see you rustling through some packages there.
Yeah, Ken. Our friend cartoonist David Chelsea, you mentioned that you have been reading comics. You've been reading graphic novels to your daughter.
Yes.
You can read them out loud.
Yes.
And David Chelsea has written an age-appropriate graphic novel for Dark Horse called Snow Angel. Cool off with Snow Angel, a new hero for all ages. An ordinary but contentious little girl becomes a crime-fighting cherub whenever she makes an angel in the snow. Wow.
Oh, so she doesn't die and become an angel who fights crime. She just...
No. And this is a pre-Frozen thing. She's not any kind of megalomaniacal weirdo.
That's good.
But yeah, she gets magic powers when she makes a snow angel.
Oh,
When I make a snow angel, I just get... I just get water down my back. Yeah, exactly. Thank you, David. And Chris, apparently, I don't believe there's any explanation, but on a trip that must have gone to... Oh, he must have been in South Dakota. He sent us two postcards. One is the USS South Dakota, so...
There it is, getting hit with a suicide kamikaze fighter.
Do states really love their namesake battleships?
They do.
South Dakota's landlocked. What do they care about naval battles?
You know, once I got to know several naval officers, I realized that a lot of them are from landlocked states.
That's where the Navy has the most romance.
I guess I had dinner with a bunch of naval officers at one point, and I thought to go around the table and say, like, where did you go to college? And invariably, they all went to like technical agricultural schools in Kansas and all these crazy places. I was like, how did you join the Navy? And it is, they're like, get me out of here. I think if you grew up in San Diego, it's like the bloom is off the rose for the Navy.
But Chris also sent us this fantastic South Dakota postcard. South Dakota generic postcard, like a, and with a barcode. Like,
I bet you could find that at Wall Drug.
Yeah, that may be where he got it. On the back, it's even more dramatic, or even more generic than that. You check a box to express to the recipient, I'm sending you this card because I'm cheap, but I still love you. I miss your body. I can't afford a phone call, etc.
That's hot.
And yeah, why is that the second one, South Dakota?
I miss your body.
Dial it down, Rawr. South Dakota. The hornier of the Dakotas. In South Dakota, I became a cowboy, finally found Wall and tried to climb it. Tried to add my face to Mount Rushmore. Great. but I do like a generic postcard. I like a generic postcard with no picture. Uh-huh. That's refreshing.
I wonder if you scanned that barcode, what it would actually bring up.
The numbers purport to be all zeros, but I cannot read barcodes with my eyes. Like, right.
Seems like a Ken Jennings talent.
I bet there have been people on Jeopardy who can just read a barcode, but I have not learned. Thank you, Chris and David, for sending those along. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived before it sank into the salt marsh and sawgrass. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
Power up fall projects with Ego at Lowe's. Every tool delivers power beyond belief. So whether it's leaves, limbs, or lawn cleanup, count on Ego to deliver the power, performance, and innovation you need. And now for a limited time, save up to $60 on select blowers, chainsaws, and pole saws. Shop Ego today at Lowe's. Offers valid through 10/1 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.